do it. It's go time.
Welcome to Go Time, your source for diverse discussions from all around the Go community. Big thanks to our partners for helping us bring you awesome pods each and every week. Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, here we go.
What's up, friends? I'm here with Jeremy Tanner, DevRel at Tailscale, and I've been using Tailscale for the past, I want to say the last year, and I consider it critical home lab infrastructure for me. As you may know, I'm a home labber, so that means I take pride in a solid home network, Wi-Fi, services that make the home run, home assistant for automation, lighting, and of course, I run Pi-hole to block ads at the network level and to protect my family from ad tracking. And Pi-hole has this web UI that you can access from the LAN. But for a while there, I just didn't have access to this service or other services like Portainer or just anything else that had a web UI or something I would access via IP on the local area network. But Jeremy, tell me about a world where via Tailscale, you can access Pi-hole, Portainer, or any of these other services you might run in your home lab and access it externally from the local area network.
Yeah, you hit it when you said anything and from anywhere. And so Pi-hole being a DNS black hole, if you notice the difference between the comfy experience that you had at home and when you were out of your house, whether it was for work, a coffee shop, or even on your mobile devices, the being able to set up a Tailscale on your mobile device and have access to the same Pi-hole and filtering rules that you do at home, wherever you have an internet connection is a thing. Same thing when talking about streaming. Instead of exposing your network storage to the internet and getting that ransomware, keeping that on your private network, but extending the private network to any device that can run the client. And so having anything that can run the client includes your Steam Deck. That's just a Linux box with the controllers grafted onto the sides of it. And so if you're somewhere that has internet connection and wants to watch some of your video, plug it up to a large TV, and if you're in a hotel room, use that as your media center that's playing the shows that you're trying to catch up on from home instead of whatever hotel TV has on it. Instead of buying a service or paying a small monthly subscription, you have compute and storage at home. It's just an easy way to get back to those instead of usually inventing a bunch of things that you'd love to do, but those sorts of things become accessible to you on your phone while you're outside the house instead of something that's neat to use, but then you miss while you're away.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I run Plex, so I'm in big agreement with that, of course. But just being able to do what you can do with Tailscale is so cool. Without having to learn all the VPN things, it's just such an easy tool to use, easy tool to install on anything, really, Linux, Windows, Mac. So easy to use. Big, big fan of Tailscale. And for my home lab users out there, you can totally use Tailscale 100% for free. You get 3 users, up to 100 devices, which is like way more devices than I think I would ever need to use Tailscale on. The free forever tier is amazing and a great place to start, and especially to use it for your home lab needs alone. Check them out at changelaw.com/Tailscale. The free forever tier is waiting for you to try it out. Again, changelaw.com/Tailscale. And make sure you tell them your friends at Changelog sent you.
Hello, friends and guests, co-hosts. Yeah, this is your friendly neighborhood Go developer and co-host, Johnny. It's been a while. I've been missing in action for a little bit, but you know, with the release of Go 1.2.1, I thought it was a good time to sort of swing back, you know, by the old farm and see how everybody's doing, and invite our good old correspondent, you know, Carl Johnson, to come back and talk to us about what's new, as he usually does for virtually every release of Go since I don't know, the last 4 or 5 or something. I think this is a habit now, Carl. You're now forever the correspondent, the new Go release correspondent. So welcome, Carl.
Thank you. I'm here with the breaking news about the new releases, and I get to come back once every 6 months.
Nice, nice. Also joining me for this exclusive, recording is Chris Brenda. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing all right. Nice day to record. Slightly overcast, but still pretty nice out.
Here too. The whole forest burning, whatever you call it, that whole smoke thing coming from everywhere. Seems like the world's on fire, honestly. There's always something going on these days.
Yeah, literally on fire these days.
Quite literally. But we're not here to talk about sad things. We're here to talk about happy things. Go has a new release, as we do every 6 months in the Go community here. And we're here to talk about Go 121, which honestly, it seems like a pretty big deal to me. Like, I went through and read the release notes and I was like, wow, they're like using generics for real now in the standards library. There's like tool improvements, there's language changes, there's new built-ins, there's a whole lot of stuff. So where to start? Carl, what is the most important part of this release for you?
For me, I would say this is a very generic release.
Here we go.
Probably in the long term, actually, there'll be other things that are more important in a way, because the generic stuff kind of could have been done anytime. But on the other hand, sort of day to day, it does make a difference that the generic stuff has come in. So for people who have been paying attention, right, Go generics were added in Go 1.18, which is now about a year and a half behind us. So it's been in there for a little while. When they were working on adding generics to Go, at one point it was sort of planned that they would just release all these generic packages alongside generics so that, all at once it would come out and you could do all these things to your slices and maps and stuff like that. But shortly before the release, there was a decision that wait a minute, let's try to get some real world experience before we just release some packages to the standard library. Because once we add it to the standard library, we're really stuck with it and we can't change it anymore because of the Go 1 guarantee. You can add new functions, but you can't take the old ones out pretty much there permanently. So what they did instead was they released an experimental package. It was at golang.org/x/exp. And so you could go there and download these generic packages for maps and slices. But finally, with Go 1.21, it's been added to the language officially. So you don't have to go import any third-party packages or download anything. It just comes along with the language automatically. And I find it's very convenient. Before generics, definitely day-to-day, it wasn't too much trouble. You didn't run into it very often. But now that it is there, it does sort of come up where it's it would be really convenient to just look at this slice and see if anything in the slice matches whatever it is I'm searching for real quick, and not have to write a whole for loop just for this, or have a utility folder that just has this defined for whatever my type is, So yeah, it makes life a little bit more convenient just to have this stuff built into the language now. So that's definitely something I'm pretty happy about.
I was very happy, especially about the slices package now leveraging the generic stuff, as we all kind of knew it would eventually, right? But the implementation is smooth. I mean, you're going to be using the functionality and not even realize you're using generics, which I think for me is the biggest value, right? It's like the language itself, how you write Go, is not changing. You're just simply calling a function and it does what's expected and it leverages the capability under the hood, right? So to me, the addition, slices now is akin to the package now is akin to sort of the slicing and dicing I do with the strings package, right? I'm always reaching out for it to do, some slicing and dicing, finding things at certain positions and this and that, whatever it is. Now I have fewer loops to write, if I'm trying to find something in a slice, or if I'm trying to compact a slice, which actually, was pleasantly surprised. It was a method added to the slices package. There's notion of compaction, sort of removing duplicate items in there. I think there's some specifics around that, but it's got a lot of utility sort of functions that are in there that are yes, this is exactly what I was waiting on, right? Could have they written these things without generics, back in the day or whatever it is? Yes, people just wrote, their own sort of utility packages and things to do that. And there were plenty before this. But now I think you're going to see a reduction for these kinds of utility packages out there, which I think is a good thing. I think one of the things that we're definitely going to be talking about is the part of the standard library is the slog, the slog, however you want to pronounce it, sort of a expansion of the log package. Personally, I think like I'm happy that it's in there, but my immediate reaction is like, I have to give up LogRS. like what am I going to miss? What am I going to, like, you know, I had that, this sort of immediate reaction because I've been using LogRS for quite a while, and other people have their own sort of favorite packages too. There's Zap. There's a few out there that people have gotten used to, but now that there's one in the standard library proper, right? It's like, okay, now, like I like the fact that I don't have to bring a third party package into my world now, right? Bar none. Like I absolutely love that, right? But it means it's gonna take, you know, getting to know a new API, a new sort of way of doing things a little bit. The output may not change, but it's a you're gonna get to learn how to use some new tooling that perhaps, you know, you've sort of been accustomed to using different things. What do you think about the? Obviously, we didn't touch on some of the built-ins. We're going to come back to the built-ins, like the min, max, clear. We're going to come back to those. But I want your opinion on the new logging capability.
Okay, you want to go to logging?
Yes, let's go to logging. And then we can always come back to the other. Logging, logging
Johnny,
is...
Do you always eat your dessert before you eat your dinner?
You know, I'm one of those people when I was growing up as a kid, if my mom put like food on a plate and said, you're not allowed to eat your meat until you've had your vegetables and things... I've been trying to, you know, now that I'm a grown man, I don't have to do that anymore. Not eat my meat first. So this is what we're doing. We're going to eat this meat first. Let's talk about the logging, and then we're going to come back to the other stuff.
Okay, we could switch over to Slog. So Slog is a new package. So Go, maybe just for background, has always had a package called Log, right? And it's just a very simple logger. It really, I think all it does is like add the timestamp to your logs. I guess it can also add the file, like the file and the line number of where the log was produced. It can optionally add that. But yeah, it's just super basic. It didn't have any like levels. Like the only level was fatal. So if you needed to just make a quick CLI where when something goes wrong, you just want to print out an error message, you could do log.fatal and that would, you know, kill your process and print out a little unhappy message. But that's been it. You know, that's been the basic Go logger. And it's been simple and usable, but I think a lot of people have more complicated needs. And so there have been a lot of third-party logging packages over the years. So you were saying LogRS or LogRS, is that how you pronounce it? Zap. Now let's just make up some fake log names for people to Google and not find. Like, you know, there's old Woody the logger.
I mean, there's the classic Log 15. Can't forget that.
I think that one's real, isn't it?
Log 15?
I think that's real. But now
we gotta It's real. It's real.
Wait, didn't we also port like a famous like Java logging library, Log4j?
Yeah, there's Log4g.
Log4g.
So the basic logging has been in there forever. And so recently, I think his name is Jonathan Amsterdam. He goes by JBA on GitHub. He made a proposal to add a new logging package to Go that would be structured logging. So a lot of these very popular logging packages, the way that they work is it's not just like you log and it dumps out a string, but you log and it structures the information into basically keys and values. So like one of the very basic keys is time, and it's, you know, time equals whatever, and there's your timestamp. Another is level. Level equals warning, or level equals info, or level equals, you know, error. The message. So message equals whatever. But you can also have more complicated logs where you're logging particular things. Like let's say you made a request to some server. You could say, you know, server hostname equals, you know, hostname equals example.com. And then you could say duration of the request is, you know, 37 milliseconds. And you can say this and that. And when you have that structured logging, you know, as an operator who's just like looking at things scroll by in your window, it's, you know, it's okay. It's not a big difference, but it's nice to have. But I think when you have like a larger corporation or, you know, enterprise, and you're putting all these logs into some sort of a store like Datadog or, you know, somebody else, Kibana, once you have all these logs in a centralized place, if it's structured, then you can search it out and you can say, okay, show me every request to example.com. get the duration for every request to example.com. Give me a histogram of that. Show me what the P99 is. You know, let me know when it's going too long and when it's going too short. And it gives you a lot of capabilities that otherwise you wouldn't have. So, you know, people have been using third-party packages for this for a long time. So now that it's come into the standard library, I think it's going to, you know, I think a lot of people are going to stop using third-party packages because they can get their job done with just the Go standard library. One thing that's nice about the design of the way that this has been added is it's not totally encapsulated. So it comes with a log formatter that will format your log lines as JSON. So like, you know, curly brackets and colons and quotation marks and all that normal JSON stuff. But you can also log it as a text format. It's called the log FMT format or something, but it uses equal signs and, you know, it's relatively easy to read just like with your own eye, but it's pluggable. So you can plug in whatever you want. So if you, you know, if you're using a particular logging host provider, you can build a sync and say, all right, well, my log provider, they accept logs in this binary format. And so we're going to like automatically, you know, build that binary and we're going to upload it to whatever server it is. We're going to post it as, you know, a protocol buffer or, you know, whatever. So it's very powerful, very capable. It's like, you know, it's the best of Go where you have these interfaces that you can extend them pretty easily. And as long as you just implement these, you know, core handful of methods, then, you know, anybody can build on top of it. So, yeah, I think if you're in the DevOps world, like this is definitely something that I think is going to change how a lot of people do things, just in the sense of like, now you can plug into this. And people can build adapters so that, you know, if you're still into using Logaris or whatever, you can build a layer where, okay, you call Logaris and then it calls into the slog package, the structured log package, and then that sends it off to whatever your final destination for your logs is. So it's very powerful. It's very interesting.
It kind of feels like this might become kind of like what the database SQL package is, where it's like, oh, there's this core. You know, we have things like SQLX or SQLC, and then you also have all your drivers and all of that. So it feels like it's building that sort of ecosystem, but for logging.
Yeah, definitely.
So now that we've had my dessert, let's continue. Let's continue on with more standard library stuff, and then we're going to come back to the core language stuff. So we mentioned like the slices stuff, but the maps also saw some additions, right, for some common operations, also leveraging the new generics capabilities. Like what are some of your favorite new things in the maps package?
Well, to be honest, my favorite thing got cut at the last second. So if you go to the experimental maps package that they had up online before they added it to the standard library, like one of the functions was called maps.keys, and it was just, you know, real stupid, simple. You call map.keys and it gives you a slice with all of the keys in the map. And,
right,
you know, it was definitely something that you could have done before. It wasn't like going to kill you, but, you know, it took it from being three lines down to one and, you know, just like one little command, just so much faster and easier to type, you know, map.keys versus like especially if you have Go imports turned on and it's automatically adding the imports and stuff for you. That's like so much easier to type than just like, okay, 4K colon equals range M, K keys equals append keys K. It's like, okay, yeah, you can do that. Like, you know, you can rattle it off pretty quick, but I'm a very slow typer. So
you don't get to have that.
Yeah.
You get five functions now: clone, copy, delete func, equal and equal func. That's it.
Right. So keys was dropped at the very last minute because right now they're working on a proposal for the next version of Go to add iterators. So if you're familiar with that from other languages like Python and JavaScript and C#, and I'm sure C++ and every other language in the world, it's just the idea that you have like something that returns elements in a list one at a time, or elements in a potentially infinite sequence one at a time. And so instead of map.keys returning the slice of all of the elements, all of the keys at once, it would like return one key at a time.
Which is an optimization, right? That you can think of it as an optimization.
Yeah. So basically, like at the last minute, they were like, well, wait a minute, we might add iterators in the next version. So we don't want it to be that map.keys is like the slow version and you have to call map.quickkeys or something, or like key zitter or something. Yeah, so right. Look forward to that. I'm sure I'll be back in 6 months to tell you that Keys is back and I'm celebrating with all of my friends out in the street.
Nice. So the last one I want to touch on in the Stand Library was the CMP or comp or however you want to call that, that package. Like I've seen that package before from, I think I've imported, there's a Google Go package called CMP. I've used that before to do, in my tests actually, to do comparison of different things. But there's a CMP package proper in the Stand Library now. Like where am I going to use this? You know, obviously based on a name, it has to do with comparison. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
So the new CMP package, yeah, I think it's definitely related to the Google CMP package in the sense that they're like both doing comparisons. That one was really focusing on like test comparisons where you're trying to say like, when I run this test, is the value that I get out the same as what I expected, or is it close enough, or is it off in some little ways? And I think it would even like print out like the fine difference of like, okay, on line 37 of this huge object, two characters are different, and they would show you exactly what it is. So the new standard library CMP is much, much, much simpler. It's basically, is it two or three functions? I need to like look it up. But one of the things is CMP.ordered, which is a generic constraint. So generic constraints are just the idea that when you're writing a generic function, you can tell it what kinds of things it can take. So CMP.ordered just means, all right, I can take anything that you can use with a less than operator, right? So strings, numbers, floating point numbers, that's about it, right? But there's a lot of different kinds of numbers. So ints, uints, int32, int64. So all of those now conform to the CMP ordered generic constraint. And then you can do CMP.compare, and that will compare two ordered things to say which of the two is bigger. So there's, I guess, and there's also CMP.less. Okay, so it is three things altogether.
It's interesting that the type ordered, like I've seen that before, right? In the now hopefully defunct constraints package. I know you have a pet peeve about that.
I have a pet peeve about that. So yeah, so again, going back to the idea that when generics were being worked on, you know, there was one school of thought of like, okay, we're doing generics. Let's just add all this stuff to the standard library and let's go. And that definitely is appealing. But the Go team held off. They're like, okay, let's see how it is in practice. And one of the packages that they worked on experimentally was called constraints. And it just had like a bunch of different generic constraints. So constraints.ordered is the same as the new CMP.ordered. But they also had constraints for other stuff. They were like integer constraints and float constraints and this and that. But after generics came out, I opened an issue on the Go issue tracker. And I said, let's just drop the whole idea of constraints, of the constraints package, because basically the only constraint that you end up using is the ordered constraint. And other than that, you don't really use it. So do we need like a whole package just for this? And so that was basically the issue I opened. In the end, they didn't quite do what I said in the issue, because I said to add it to sort, like, so it would be sort.ordered. And instead they made a whole new package, but I still feel vindicated because the constraints package didn't make it in. So my contribution to Go 1.21 was that they didn't add a new package.
A non-addition. All right.
A non-addition addition. So yeah, I saved Go from, you know, another, I don't know how many lines of code that would have been, 20 lines of code that they didn't need.
Right. So let's swing back around to some of the built-in stuff. Chris, have you ever wanted a min and a max built in?
I think so. I think there's been a number of times that I've wanted to be able to just be like, give me the smallest thing without having to sort or iterate through a slice myself or a map. But I am personally much more excited for the clear function, because I have had to clear lots of maps before. And it's just kind of annoying to have to go through and be like, let me just write a little loop to take care of this. So I'm very excited about that. But I am excited about these min and max functions. I think they will come in handy. Maybe not all of the time, but at least some of the time. Which is how I feel about generics in general, and about this, like, I'm very happy with this package in general, because I feel like, you know, my worry when generics were first being talked about was they'll be sprayed everywhere. And it seems like we've been very good at being reserved with this and being very judicious with our usage of generics and putting in the right place and being very careful with how we add them, especially the standard library. So I think it's like little stuff like this just feels very elegant, little small, little, you know, quality of life improvements. You know, you're not getting rid of a ton of code by getting rid of min or max or whatever, but you make go a little bit more concise that way. And I like that quite a bit.
Yeah. With min, max, and clear, for all three of them, part of the motivation is that floating point numbers are the devil's numbers, and they will try to eat you whenever you aren't looking at them. So with a map, you can have a map, and normally your maps, most of the time, the key will be like a string or something string-like, and then, you know, you have the values in the map. But you're allowed to have a map from numbers to other things. So you could have a map from ints to whatever, and that makes sense. That's fine too. But the problem comes when you have a map from floats to something else. So that's totally legal in the language. There's nothing stopping you from doing it. But with floating point numbers, there's such a thing as not a number or NaN. So if you do certain operations in floating point, it just like it gives up, and instead of returning a number, it returns not a number. I don't think it's if you divide by zero, because I think that returns infinity. But anyway, just if you do the wrong thing with floating point, suddenly it gets mad at you. It returns not a number. And then not a number basically like glues up everything else that it touches. So if you have a slice and you want to say, okay, what's the biggest thing in this slice? Well, if you have a NaN in there, suddenly like the whole thing just becomes moot because the biggest thing is not a number. And then if you have a map, you can have the NaN become a key. But then when you go to delete the key, you can't delete it because the NaN is not equal to itself. And so then you try to delete it and it gets like stuck and your map is just filling up with more and more not a number numbers. Yeah. So it's like, so basically clear is the only way if for some reason you are using a map from float to something else, you probably shouldn't be doing that, or you should examine your life choices if you're doing that. But if you are doing that, it's possible that these NaNs will get like stuck in there, and the only way to get them out is with the new clear built in.
You're making me hungry with all this non talk.
Oh yeah.
I'm like, it's yeah. non.
Let's go to Nando Perry's after this.
So, okay. The last thing I want to touch on the built-ins. Well, we had a whole episode recently on Go 121 generics in particular, but maybe we can briefly touch on sort of the changes that have been clarified with the type inference in the spec for as far as the whole generics thing is concerned, right? With the type inference, like, is there, like, how can we like briefly summarize that?
I think for the most part, if you're using it, you won't really notice the difference because it should just work. So for the most part, when you use generics in Go, it will do some very light, very mild type inference of like, okay, you've got this input and that, and so I can tell from context that you must want, you know, this to be an int or to be this particular struct or whatever. And so they've just slightly improved it now where it also works for when you have like one generic function is calling another generic function. And so specifically, if you're doing like the slices package with the CMP package and you're like, okay, I want you to sort this according to this CMP call, you know, it should all just like work automatically and you don't even notice that it's different or better. But if you like took that same code and you brought it back to Go 1.20, it would say, I can't tell what type you mean here. Please add a type annotation. And you'd be like, oh, okay, whatever. So it just saves you a little bit of typing and, you know, physical typing and as well as, how do you call the other kind of typing? Also mathematical typing. It saves you both kind of typing. But for the most part, you shouldn't notice it. It should just like work and you don't have to think about it.
Right, right. When I saw this in the release notes, I was like, it's about time, right? So what I'm referring to specifically is if you've ever sort of work with the Go routines inside of loops, you probably run in it, especially as a newbie, you probably run into the whole loop variable closure bug and you're wondering what the heck's going on. But yeah, it seems like there's some initial work around sort of preventing that from being a gotcha for people who don't know how to handle that particular case. I think there's a flag now you can sort of turn on or something.
So the background for this is that, this definitely bites everybody at least once. And like, I think with some things you get bitten once and then it just never happens again. But with this one, it's still like every 6 months or so you get bitten by it again.
You forgot.
So the way that for loops work in Go is that when you you say, you know, for I colon equals range, whatever, that I is a new variable and it exists inside of the loop, but not outside of the loop. And it's like, okay, that part is fine. That makes sense. But the problem is it only gets created once per loop. So the whole loop is just reusing the same I every time. And it turns out that this causes bugs when you're like building a closure, or if you take a pointer inside of the loop, you end up taking a pointer to the same thing or closing over the same variable every time. And so you'll do this thing where you'll be like, okay, I'm going to write these functions and I want them all to, like, let's say take one element in a slice and then do something to it. And then you go through and it's like, oh, actually they all took the last element in the slice. And you're like, why are they all taking the last element of the slice? This is crazy. And it's like, oh, it's because of this bug. So Go has this really strong emphasis on backward compatibility and like not changing things and make it so that like if you're writing code today, it'll keep working tomorrow and you don't have to worry about the language changing under your feet. So in general, they haven't wanted to change the meaning of existing things in the code. But for this example, Russ Cox like actually went through, you know, however many millions of lines of code that Google has inside of their internal private repos. He looked at a bunch of public repos. He got his hands on as much code as he could. And he was like, if I made it so that by default, it just creates a new variable every time you go through the loop, instead of just once at the top, would that break code? And he couldn't find any examples of like code that wasn't already buggy that would have a new bug because of it. And he's like, okay, I haven't found any examples of this creating a bug. And I know from experience that not having this, you know, routinely creates bugs. So let's just go ahead and try it out. So in Go 1.21, it's not the default yet. It's still a Go experiment. So if you set the Go experiment equals loop var setting, then your program can try it out. And if you run that and you run your test and you're like, oh my God, my test was passing before, but now it's not, then that means that you must have been like the one person in the world who had a bug with this being the other way around. But for everybody else, it should just save you the next time you accidentally run into this particular issue.
And when this finally makes it into whatever version it makes it into, even the existing codes that redeclares the loop variable inside of the loop won't break. It'll just continue to work as is until you're ready to just remove the new loop variable.
Yeah, it's one of these features where it's gated behind the go.mod file. So you have to say in your go.mod file that you want to use the new features of Go. And so if you have an old program that, you know, it's relying on the bug to work somehow, it won't just silently upgrade itself.
Right. And probably GoVet will probably tell you, like, if you're using a version that does support the automatic loop variable declaration, GoVet will probably tell you, like, hey, you don't need to have this extra declaration in your code, which is nice.
Yeah, there's some way you can run your tests where the test itself will like print out something where it's like, hey, this result changes based on whether or not I have the Go loop variable experiment on. And so you can run that now and it'll print out all of the spots where it's like, something looks a little bit different with it turned on versus not turned on.
I was going to say that if you turn on the loop var thing and your tests fail, it's probably because you were using it within your test. You had some nice little loop for table test and you just weren't running all the other tests because you didn't know, because you weren't passing in the right things. I feel like that's probably more likely than, you know, you are actually using this really weird component of Go for something useful.
So let's switch gears to some tooling. It seems like there's a couple things I want to touch on. The PGO is which was introduced in the previous version of Go, now has gone GA. I must admit I haven't had a chance to dive deeper into profile guided optimization. Like, what's the 15 second value prop here for PGO?
So I also haven't used this in production yet. The basic idea is that when you run the Go compiler, it's very fast, but part of how it's very fast is it's not doing super optimization. It's just sort of giving like everything a quick once over, and then, you know, basically that's good enough. But with profile guided optimization, what you do is you build your binary and then you run it in production for a little while. And then while it's running in production, it writes out a little thing saying, oh, this loop, I did it a bunch. It would be better if this was inlined. And this loop over here, it'd be better if I did it this way or that way, or if I moved this variable so that it's closer to this other one. And so it'll just save all of that stuff into a thing. And then you take that file and you run the compiler again with the profile guided optimization file. And then the second binary it produces will be, you know, better optimized. And I forget what they said in the document, but I think they saw like 10% or so better performance when you did it this way. So for some people, that could be a big difference.
Yeah, that sounds like a sort of a low effort way of identifying sort of hot paths and things of that nature, and sort of basically, yeah, just not having to sort of do, you know, dive into a profiler and sort of do the typical thing we do with, you know, with pprof and everything else, and trying to figure out where you have too many allocations, et cetera, et cetera. So this is more of a passive way of generating, you know, some insight for you, and you can then at your leisure go and sort of refactor and optimize. Would that be a proper understanding? This is more of a passive approach.
Yeah, I think the main challenge here is just that it needs some real world data to build its profile optimization against. And so this is basically why I've been too lazy to do it, is that probably what you need to do is in your testing environment or your dev environment or something, or if you have like a sophisticated environment where you have like canary rollouts, you might say, okay, we're going to run our canaries on 10% of machines, and then they will collect the profile guided optimization files. And then we'll build a new release where we use those or something. So it's a little bit tricky in that regard. But I think if you have the infrastructure to get this going, it's basically free money. You know, it's like, okay, here's this way that we can run this. And then all of our stuff is just going to be faster in perpetuity. Like once you set up the DevOps pipeline to make this happen automatically, then it's like, okay. And now the company just saves, you know, have whatever percentage on CPU for the rest of time.
Which I imagine if you're running very high scale operations, then any sort of, you know, 2 to 7% reduction in resource utilization means many, many dollars, or whatever your form of currency is. That means a lot of savings there.
I like that it can like just get better over time. If it's like, if you do integrate it with your whole workflow, just like future releases of Go that get better and better at this. It's like, you don't have to do anything extra. It's like, oh, it's already built into my whole workflow and my whole ecosystem and all of that. So if I upgrade to a new version of Go when there's more better optimizations, then I literally don't have to do anything to get to benefit from those things, which is really cool.
Indeed, indeed. So next up we have in the whole tooling thing, and something I haven't yet played around with, there's forward and backwards compatibility with the Go toolchain. Like, what is that about?
So the go.mod file for some time now has had a line in it, which is the Go version. And if you set the Go version, up until now, it hasn't really done a whole lot. It basically just, it tells other modules, you know, this is the version of Go that I was built with and that I expect. And if you try to use a Go module that has like a future version versus what you're building your application with, it'll basically just print out a little warning and say, hey, just so you know, this one module expects me to be on, you know, Go 1.20, but I'm actually only on Go 1.19. But, it was just a warning. It wasn't like a big deal. But now there's new built-in optimization where it can automatically fetch the version of Go that you expect to be built with. So you can specify, I expect to be built with Go 1.21.2. And right now that won't work because 1.21.2 isn't out. But once it is out, it will automatically...
You're living in the future, Carl.
Maybe this is the version of Go that's like so bulletproof that they never have bug releases for it. It's like, no, we just got it perfect on 0.0. But yeah, so, you know, it will automatically go online, get that version, you know, download it into a cache spot, and then run that compiler all for you. Now, you can turn it off. I think there are people who are going to be in high security environments where it's like, no, we're not going to let something automatically download the newest version of Go. Everything that we run has to be like inspected with a fine tooth comb and blah, blah, blah. But I think for a lot of people, this is just going to be very convenient. It's like, oh, you know, if I have one person on the team and they like release something and on their machine, they already ran, you know, homebrew upgrade or apt upgrade or whatever, it's not going to break on my machine. My machine will just silently update itself to match theirs. So that's pretty cool.
This is a changelog news break. You can add Meta's Code Llama to the ever-expanding list of code-generating LLMs. Based on Llama 2, Code Llama comes in three sizes, 7 billion parameters, 13 billion, and 34 billion. And it comes in three different varieties, a general model, one tuned for NLP instructions, and one fine-tuned for Python. How does it stack up? Well, Meta claims it outperforms other publicly available LLMs, and it shares the same open-ish license as Llama itself, which is free for research and commercial use, unless you compete with Meta. You just heard one of our five top stories from Monday's Changelog News. Subscribe to the podcast to get all of the week's top stories and pop your email address in at changelog.com/news to also receive our free companion email with even more developer news worth your attention. Once again, that's changelog.com/news.
So another thing that personally I haven't had use for, but I hear is all the rage in some circles, is WebAssembly. So there's a experimental port of WebAssembly system interface, like into Gonad. That you can specify, you know, your goose and gorch environment variables to get access to that WASM stuff. Like, how interesting is that for either of you?
That's pretty exciting. I've used WASM before, just like to play around with it in the browser. But in the browser, it's always a little bit of a awkward fit because you want everything to be as small as possible. And so as soon as you're compiling the whole Go runtime, it's like you start off with like a 3 megabyte binary or something like that. And for a system where you're just like, you know, you have a CLI tool or something, it's like, oh, 3 megabytes is not a big deal. But if you're running a website and you want, you know, users to come to the site and you're like, oh, they've got to download 3 megabytes before they can load my little, you know, image, that's kind of not great always. So I think that's always sort of limited the adoption of Go in WebAssembly on the front end. But on the back end, you know, it's like, who cares? Like the final binary is probably going to be like 100 megs, but nobody cares. It's like, it's trivial on the back end. So I think this could be really exciting for serverless functions, for compute at edge, for things like that, where it's like, okay, now we can deliver our Go binaries out to the edge super fast, you know, have them run on every request and, you know, deliver results, you know, close to users in milliseconds or microseconds. I think this could be really, really exciting.
Yeah, I think the back end is definitely the more compelling part of this. I also think like this could be used to make like, you know, interesting plugin systems and whatnot, because WebAssembly, like, there's so many different runtimes. You can easily embed them into your language. So making it so that Go has this kind of extra layer of access now, where it's not just kind of like, oh, I can't really talk to a file system. I have to depend on the runtime giving me this stuff. Now there's a standard interface that, you know, anybody can use. It's really nice. And I'm glad to see that Go is also pushing to get into the WebAssembly space, because I think right now it's a lot of C, C++, Rust, and there's like, you know, some other languages floating around. But I've always been like, no, Go should be in there as well. Like Go should be like right up with Rust and C as languages you can use, you know, for these edge computes and for all this other stuff.
There was a really interesting talk at GopherCon, I want to say 2022, by the creator of SQL C, whose name escapes me, but he was talking about using WebAssembly for plugins in Go. And basically, yeah, it was like he wanted to add a plugin system to SQL C, his Go, you know, SQL compiler, whatever you want to call it. He wanted a plugin system for that. And so he ended up doing it with WebAssembly, because that was something where it's like, okay, if it's in WebAssembly, I know that the plugin can't just like scribble all over my user's hard drives. I can put it into a nice little sandbox and it can be allowed to, you know, modify the SQL files, but not, you know, do things that it's not supposed to do. And so I can protect my users that way with the plugins. So it could be really interesting to see if, you know, maybe Caddy or, you know, some other things could pick this up as a way of having plugins, but not necessarily letting the plugins just run any arbitrary code, but you can trust that they're only going to run code that you approve of.
Yeah, I think that's Kyle Conroy on GitHub.
That sounds right. Yes.
Maybe the SQLC package, yeah.
There's some minor changes that I think you're excited about, Carl. You want to touch on those?
Oh, minor changes. So I have to promote it because nobody else will promote it since I was the one who implemented it. So I'm the one who brought Funk to Go. I want everybody to know this. So a couple versions back, there's flags.funk. So flags is the Go command line flags parsing package. I know a lot of people use other packages, you know, like Cobra or Viper or whatever. But if you want to stick to the standard library, which I recommend, but not everybody does, then you can use the flag package. And the flag package has a little helper called Funk. And flags.funk, what it'll do is it'll just take whatever you set in your command line argument and just pass it to a little function as a string. And in your function, you can return an error. It's just a very simple and convenient way of quickly writing a command line flag parsing thingamajigger. So in Go 1.21, someone in the issues tracker said, hey, we should have flags.boolfunk, which is basically the same as flags.funk, except for it works for flags that don't necessarily have an argument. So let's say you had a flag called, dash verbose or something like that, and you didn't need to have a setting for it. You could just say, dash verbose. Now with Go 1.21, you can have that just sent off to your function in the same way that you could for something else where it's taking an argument. So I don't know. It was simple. It was like, it's one of those things where there's a lot of stuff. If you want to get into open source, there's a lot of stuff in the Go issue tracker where it's like, we need somebody to write something and it's only, 3 lines, 5 lines, 20 lines. It's not that much. And then you end up writing tests and the tests are longer than the thing that you write. So I don't know. I see this all the time, like on Reddit and different places of like, I want to do open source. Where do I go? How do I start in open source? And my answer is always like, you'd be surprised. There's some like really low hanging fruit in the Go project. And it can be pretty fun to, just implement it and, send it out there. And the team are really understanding. I know for like one of the first things I sent in, I was like, I can't figure out how to test this. Like, I know what change to make, but I don't know how to test my change. And they were like, okay, not a big deal. We'll write the test for you. And, they helped me through that and it was great. So definitely if you're looking for something to contribute to, check out the Go project.
Sweet. I think it's time to switch to some would say their favorite part of the show, which is unpopular opinions.
By some, do you mean you, Johnny?
What? Me? Little old me? I don't know. Let's get the jingle going, shall we? All right, Carl, I know you brought something spicy.
All right.
Lay it on us.
Here's my spicy take. My spicy take is that XML is better than YAML because there are situations where XML is appropriate, but there is no situation where YAML is appropriate.
Damn, shots fired.
So now to defend my position and therefore make it so that it becomes a popular opinion. Although maybe not. This one might be spicy enough that I can't defend it well enough. Let's talk about XML first. So XML got a really bad reputation. And the reason it got a really bad reputation is because people were using it for things that it should never have been used for. So XML, it stands for Extensible Markup Language. And if you're using it as an extensible markup language, it's actually really great. So like, let's say you're working on something and you're like, I'm making a new kind of book and I need to, annotate all of the verses in the Bible and have the chapter headings and stuff. It's like, it's great for that. It's really good for when you have a document and you need to have, some things are italicized and some things are in a foreign language and subtitles and, all that stuff. It's really good for that. It's not good if it's like, okay, I need to configure this server. And the server needs to know if this value is true or false. It's like, no, that's bad. Don't do that. That's not a good use for XML. But XML does have some uses for which it's appropriate. And I think the fact that now everybody is writing React and they're writing it with JSX, and JSX is basically just inline XML, I think that shows that there are cases where actually XML is pretty good. Now, YAML, on the other hand, I think is never good. There's always something better than YAML. And so we finally made it to Go 1.21, and I'm very happy about this. And you know why? Because YAML repeatedly bit me in the behind on Go 1.20. Ask me why.
Why?
Well, when you say in your test file, test this against Go 1.20, it interprets that as Go 1.2. And so it was like two or three different times I had a repo where I'm like, these tests aren't passing. Why are my tests not passing? I'm just upgrading it to Go 1.20. And it was like, oh no, I've decided that this is Go 1.2. And so YAML is always going to do that to you.
Oh, snap. You just reminded me. I think I had that issue in a GitHub action when I changed a version of a build to 1.20. I think I had that exact same issue. Because it's the YAML for the GitHub workflows. I ran into that issue. Oh my God.
So yeah, my take is that YAML, I mean, I understand why people do YAML, but there are better choices. You should use, you know, TOML. You can use Q, the thing from Raj Pepe. You can use, or I guess it's from a lot of people, but he's the guest on the show who is most associated with it. You could use, you know, lots of things. I like how Caddy does it, where with Caddy, the canonical language that Caddy understands is JSON, but they have adapters, right? And so if you want to write YAML, you can, but it'll just take that YAML and turn it into JSON behind the scenes. And then they also have like a specific Caddy language. And so you can give it the Caddy language and then it turns that into JSON behind the scenes. And you can give it an Nginx config and it'll turn that into JSON behind the scenes. I think that's like, that is probably like, if you have the cycles and time to spare, that's probably the best solution for most people. But when the only way to do it is YAML, it's like, no, it's just too error prone. There's too many things. You just have to always quote everything.
You just have to quote properly. Quote properly. Don't forget, you know, quote everything. Make sure you have the right number of tabs and the right number of spaces. You know, just don't, you know, indentations, you know, like if you've ever done Python, you know the life of having the appropriate spacing and things. So yeah, it's
well, just the YAML specification has all these features that nobody ever uses, which because they're like really confusing and hard, and it's like you can include documents inside of other documents with references and stuff. And it's like, oh man, I don't want to have to understand any of this stuff. And then if you're not careful, it'll be like, oh yeah, the first three things I fed it to understood that. But then the third one was just like using some parser that they found on the back of a truck and it doesn't understand it. And it's like, oh man. It's like YAML never appropriate. XML is sometimes appropriate.
I have equal dislike for YAML. Like there's been a few too many times I'm trying to like configure something in Kubernetes. And I'm like, why isn't this working? And it's like, oh, you didn't tab this over enough, or you tab this thing over too much. And I'm like, this is obnoxious. For XML, though, I'm a big fan of XML, mostly because you have like namespaces and things in XML, which allows you to actually compose things better. Like if you want that with like JSON, you have to use like JSON-LD or something like that, which makes it a lot more interoperable than other things. I think the main problem with XML is that like it's not quote unquote readable, or people don't like to read it. But I don't think people like to read any of these formats. Like human readability probably shouldn't be the same thing we're trying to achieve with like an efficient machine format, because machines like lots of very detailed information and humans don't like looking at lots of detailed information. We want like syntax and colors and pretty things to help us parse out information. But yeah, I think as far as your opinion goes, yes, like just dumpster all of YAML. But I'm like, use XML for more things. I'm like, if you want to configure a server with XML, that's fine. But like, provide some useful tools to like present the configuration to humans or things like that. Cause yeah, trying to read XML, like just a big blob of it, is just unfun.
Well, it's just tricky, right? Like JSON got lucky that they found the primitive types that solve a lot of people's uses of like, okay, if you have numbers, you have strings, arrays, objects, bool, that's all you need usually. I would say the big problem with JSON is there's nothing for timestamps or date times. So that's like something you run into a whole lot of, like, you know, JSON is almost right, except for it doesn't have the date time. XML, I think the issue is that it's like, it's all strings, and it's like, and then you have to add the other layer on top. And so if you're somebody and you're like, oh, I'm going to use XML for this thing and I need it to be true or false, it's like, okay, in this one, is it that there's an attribute called true, or is it called yes, or is it called on? Or is there like a tag and there's a sub tag called on and stuff like that? I mean, it's all things that you can work out. And if you have, you know, if you have the schema, if you have the convention of like, okay, in this application, we always do Booleans this way, then it's not a big deal. But I think for something where it's like, you're just trying to generically communicate it from one thing to another, it can be a little bit tricky. And that's where I think XML got a bad reputation.
Yeah. I feel like the core problem with JSON is that you have to do everything based on conventions, right? There's no way to say that, like, you can't change a name from, like, first name to name, or, like, everything will break, which is, like, that. But, again, like, there's JSON-LD to help with that. The thing I really don't like about JSON as well is that everything is, like, a 53-bit floating point number.
Don't use that 54th bit. That's not for you.
It's like... Yeah, so, some numbers you can't represent, or like, you know, the I want this to be go 1.20, but you're taking this as a number, so you think it's 1.2, and like, I really meant that to be a string, but I have to like quote this and whatnot. So it's all a lot of like edges and trade-offs and all of that. But yeah, I don't think anybody has time for YAML like that. That got to go.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, the JSON spec definitely has like flaws. It lets you have the same key twice, and like officially that's allowed but like discouraged or something, but like in practice it's like, no, you're just gonna break everything, don't do that.
That's a bug.
Yeah, that's a bug. I mean, the Go parser,
that's a bug.
I think it like it puts up with it. The Go JSON encoder decoder will put up with the same key being in there twice, but you know, don't do it. It's just gonna break stuff and make problems.
Wait, Johnny, are you a fan of YAML? Do you like YAML?
You know, at this point, I've written so much damn CloudFormation in YAML that it's like second nature to me now. I don't mind it. I've come across all the weird ways YAML can break because I write all my CloudFormation YAML by hand. So yeah, I would not trade that in for XML though, or even JSON for that matter.
Do you run it through something like Prettier or something that like config checks it and like make sure that you didn't like put the spaces in the wrong place or something?
I used to, and then they started behaving weirdly at times, and now I don't have that. I don't have any of those things. I don't have any of those things. I'm like, I'm the computer. I'm like, you know, I'm the computer now. Yeah, I'm like, seriously, like the thing I'm like literally like I'm touching YAML every day. I'm touching CloudFormation every day. So now I know all the where all the bodies are buried. So yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, none of these are fun to write by hand. Or like JSON XML are definitely not fun to write by hand. YAML is like okay-ish if you do it every day like you do, Johnny. But I think that's why we have things like Q as well that are up and coming, and people being like, okay, let's try and solve like the writing human writable and readable configuration and then turn that into other stuff. So perhaps one day in the future, we can replace YAML with something like Q or some other like slightly nicer to use format for the people that want it, and the kind of YAML warriors like yourself, Johnny, can keep on keeping on. I mean, it's like, you know, people write Python all the time and it's fine. So it's like,
right,
these,
yeah, yeah,
white space delimited things are not, you know, unusable. It's just, you know, people that don't write it that often might stumble upon stuff, and we should.
Yeah. And there are tools for these people. Like, you know, like in my case, in my ecosystem, because I'm doing cloud stuff all the time on AWS, you know, if you want to, you can use the CDK, which will generate YAML for you, and it'll be, you know, perfectly syntaxed, you know, YAML. And again, you can have tools that generate the YAML for you if that's not your cup of tea, right? I'm just so used to working with it every day that it doesn't bother me at this point. But yeah, I can totally, I just don't. The XML bit though, Carl, you got I have scar tissue from XML, man.
I think, Johnny, you've been working a little longer than I have, so you probably saw like when XML was like really abusing people. I think I came in late enough that like I had like heard all the tales of people being hurt by XML, but like everybody had switched to JSON when I started.
Yeah, there's a whole oof. Yeah, that some of us have battle scars from the good old XSLT days, the old, you know, XML and all like variants upon variants of like, ugh, yeah, I don't want to relive those days. Like, I'll take YAML over that nonsense any day. But I mean, granted, there's lots of legacy systems that run and operate on that stuff today. So I can't knock it. It's just not in a modern day, if you're going to pick, you know, a markup or any sort of configuration language, except unless you like somebody from on high says you can't use any modern techniques or languages, you know, then yeah, stay away from XML, please.
I mean, and maybe this is an unpopular opinion. I think engineers probably shouldn't have to touch these things in their day-to-day anyway. Like, I think part of the problem we have is, especially when it comes to APIs and trying to evolve things, is that, like, you know, HTTP is this wonderful protocol that you can do all this nice content negotiation for, and no one can do it because, like, I don't know, you're like, hey, API, send me back this other thing. It's like, how about JSON? That's all I'm going to send you. Because, like, everybody, you know, you choose one, and then it's like, I'm just going to use this one thing. And I feel like maybe we should just, like, not, like, have better abstraction layers on top. Like, kind of like what Q does, where it's just, like, developers and engineers get to touch the nicer things. And then the computers that are talking to each other decide, like, oh, I'll send this to you in JSON. I'll send this to you in XML. Or I'll send this to you in YAML. And then people don't have to deal with that nastiness.
Or protobuf.
Or protobuf. Yeah. Or whatever. So I think, like, I wasn't around. I wasn't heavily doing software development during the good old XML days. But it feels like perhaps part of the problem was that we were operating a little too low in the stack, and we're trying to do too many advanced things without explaining to people what it is we were trying to do, which is, you know, growing pains of an industry. So a number of episodes ago, I had this unpopular opinion that Johnny, you heard something, and I said, no, that's what you heard. That's not what I said. And it was about Waterfall and the Waterfall paper. And I said that the Waterfall paper, the development process explained in the Waterfall paper is far superior to any of the practices we have today, right? Any of the development process we have today. That was, in fact, an unpopular opinion with our listeners. I don't think it should be. So I have written a blog post.
I disagree.
And that blog post is now up live on the Changelog website. So
nice.
If you want to go read why I think the Waterfall paper contains a very good software development process, and also perhaps improve your own process. Part of the blog post is about things you can take from that paper and a few other papers to make your software development process better, no matter what your process is. Go check out that blog post. I think we can put that in the show notes as well.
All right, the folks who disagreed with Chris, now you have his written rebuttal to your disagreement. He disagrees with your disagreement.
Don't get a writer angry at you. Yeah,
I know, right? Yeah, you will get back words. Awesome. That's been a great show. Thanks again, Carl, for coming on the show. We'll see you in another 6 months with the next release.
All right, see you in 6 months with 1.22. I've got some good stuff cooking in there. I've already merged at least one thing into the I've already got two things into the 1.22 for me to brag about when that comes out. But I'll keep you guys on the edge of your seats for the next 6 months on what they are.
Nice, nice. Oh, we can go read the notes. Read the
Oh, just like scan through GitHub issue tracker. You could do that too. That's so fun.
The commits, the messages, all that activity.
That's like people who read the book before they watch the movie. Like, no, don't read the book first. Watch the movie first.
Right. They're like, yeah, oh, that's not how I went in the book. Awesome. All right, y'all, and thanks, Chris, for being my co-host, and that is all we have for you folks.
All right, that is Go Time for this week. What are your favorite new features in Go 1.21? Anything in there you don't like? Let us know in the comments. There's a link in your show notes. We'd love to hear from you. Oh, and don't forget to check out Changelog News if you haven't yet. The software world moves fast. Keep up the easy way with our free podcast plus email newsletter that drops on Mondays. Subscribe today at changelog.com/news. Thanks once again to our partners, Fassy.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. And to our beat freak in residence, Breakmaster Cylinder. Coming up next, Natalie, Johnny, and Chris welcome back V Corvus to discuss prototyping with Go. Stay tuned right here. We'll talk to you again next time on Go Time.